thank you all for coming again, and we love to see these young faces among the crowd. Hopefully they will be the future generation of internationally educated and expert people in town. We're very fortunate today to have the speaker, Dr. James Zogby, speaking on a very timely subject. It can't be any more timely subject, any more hotter subject on the international scene now. Dr. Zogby received his BA degree from Le Moyne College in Syracuse and a doctorate degree from Temple University in 1975. Both universities subsequently awarded him Distinguished Alumni Awards. In 1995, he received an honorary doctorate from the Le Moyne College, and in 2008, an honorary doctorate from Cairo University in Egypt. In 1993, he co-chaired a project called Builders for Peace with Congressman Mel Levine, under the directions of Vice President Al Gore. They did a lot of groundbreaking work at that time in the early 90s after signing the peace agreement. In 1995, he founded the Arab American Institute, which he is still its president. It serves as the political and policy research arm of the Arab American community. If you need any data, any statistics, any information about the Arab American community throughout the US, then all you need to go is to his site and look it up, aaiusa.org. He's a scholar and a writer. He authored several books, countless articles and blogs. He has syndicate TV shows and newspaper columns in the US and throughout the Arab world. He is also the managing director of Zogby Research Services, and you all heard about Zogby Research and statistical analysis and polling organization. It's headed by his brother, John, whom we had in Cleveland about maybe 4 years ago. James also testified in several congressional hearings at the United Nations panels, numerous of them, and at international conventions all over the world. He has few copies of two books outside the room, Arab Voices and 20 Years After Oslo. He will be happy to sign them at the end of the lecture. Thank you again for coming, and please, Dr. Zogby.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for coming. I cannot claim to be the visionary who picked exactly the right topic at the right time. It was foisted upon me by the, pardon? I'll speak up. It's a trait I inherited from my father. He used to say, if you want people to listen to you, speak softly, because then they have to pay attention. That's my son, and I'm turning him off. I've actually answered calls. He's on the phone now. Okay. They'll be held to pay for hanging up. I was going to come and talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict, what had just happened and what was about to happen at the United Nations. We don't know actually what will happen at the UN, but I assume that the issue will come forward. But I was asked instead to speak on this, and it's obviously very timely. The only problem with speaking on this is that it's like trying to capture a fast-moving train. It is changing all the time. And frankly, what we say today may not be there tomorrow, but what I'll try to pull out are what I think are some central truths and issues about what is unfolding, ask some questions that I think we all need to be asking, and make some observations that I hope will shine a light. The first thing I'd say is that this conversation we're having tonight is a conversation that we should have had 10 years ago. I remember when we were about to go into Iraq. I'm on the Democratic National Committee's chair of the Resolutions Committee in the party, and I I wanted to introduce a resolution saying let's not do this because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know enough about the country. I asked questions about the Christians. I asked questions about Kurds. I asked questions about, do we know what will happen when the regime goes? And if we don't, then what are we doing? To me, it made no sense to go into a country and become part of their history when you do not know their past, and now become part of their story moving forward, but we did. And the consequences are still with us. Frankly, every major concern that we're going to be dealing with in the Middle East for the next generation will in some way be a function of the mess we created with this war in Iraq. Going into a country whose history and culture you do not understand, and the consequences of your actions you do not know, create problems that you can't control. And frankly, the consequences of the war and the unintended consequences of the war are what are playing out right now. What were those consequences? Number one, we not only got rid of the regime, but we weirdly, Paul Bremer, who knew nothing about Iraq, decided that a great idea would be to impose a Lebanon model on Iraq and create a sectarian system of governance with portioning out positions by sect. And so you took a Sunni minority that had been in control, totally disenfranchised them, and empowered groups that were, interestingly enough, related to Iran and had close ties with Iran, emboldening Iran in the broader region, and creating a bitterly resentful Sunni minority now who felt that they had no stake in the future of the country. You also unleashed a dynamic in the country that played out for several years with horrific terrorist bombings that took countless numbers of lives. And so sectarianism and emboldening Iran were two components. Remember, one of the controlling factors that had contained Iran, for better or for worse, was the regime of Saddam Hussein. Saddam is gone and Iran is now basically the regional hegemon. We also did grave damage to our country and our image in the region. And it's something we don't like to think about. I mean, we still, you know, nobody gets up in the morning and at the end of having fixed themselves up and says, "Jesus, you're a mess." You know, we like to say nice things about ourselves, and we actually like to believe the nice things about ourselves. But the reality is that the world sees us differently. They see us by what we do, not by what we say about ourselves. So in the entire time during the Bush administration, I'd get called in every time they'd have a new public diplomacy czar, and they'd say, "What do we do?" And I'd say, the first thing is stop doing what you're doing. Because people don't judge you by what you say, they judge you by what you do. You can have the nicest TV ads, but Abu Ghraib comes out and it's gone. People hear about torture and it's gone. They hear about rendition and black sites and it's gone. They see what you do to Fallujah and it's gone. And so the net result is that damage was done to the integrity of our country in a way that has taken a toll that is still not erased. Our memories are short. Their memories are long. Memories are long because it happened to them. We have the luxury of forgetting because we didn't. I mean, you're still angry about that? Think about a husband and wife, you know. I mean, husband does something really stupid, wife's going to remember it for a long time. He's going to say, "You're still on that one?" And she says, "Yeah, because you still didn't make up for it." So the point is, we still have a problem here that we don't understand. And therefore, when John McCain, who never saw a country he didn't want to bomb, would suggest, "Let's do this, and we ought to just do it," the sense is, hold back because you are not the conveyor of good in the world. I believe I want us to be, but to the world we are not seen that way. And, you know, we do a lot of polling. Interestingly enough, our polling numbers are not bad in the Arab world. They're bad everywhere. And that's true. I mean, actually, the numbers in Spain and in Italy were lower than they were in some Arab countries. People were upset about our, you know, unilateralism and our brashness and our with us or against us and our other behaviors. Other consequence was creating a war weariness and a wariness in the American public. I actually think that this ISIS group, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Sham, which is translated to the Levant, meaning the East, the Arab East, the greater Syria region, I think it's a war worth doing. I think it's something that needs to happen. It's a group that needs to stop to be stopped. But when you have an America that has tarnished itself in the region and created a weariness at home, the war that we should be fighting, we're restrained from putting ourselves into it fully because people have said, don't go there. So, I mean, here we have a situation where the president wants to go to war, but it says no boots on the ground. Well, anybody in the military will tell you that's a hell of a way to have a war. You can't really win a war that way. Somebody's got to control the areas that you liberate, and you can't really liberate them unless you liberate them on the ground. You can blow them up, but somebody's got to hold them and put them back together again. And if we don't do it, I'm not quite sure where they come from to do it. But the point is that the American people have no tolerance for it. The kind of war that people want right now is one of those ones that comes on the cheap, you know, where you just bomb things long distance and nobody gets hurt from our side. Not quite sure what happens on their side. That doesn't really, it's not really of interest. So that sort of sets the backdrop for this. A situation where our country is, in fact, the only country capable of leading, a group that is absolutely deplorable, smart but deplorable, and a situation where because of the consequences of the war that we shouldn't have fought, our hands are tied and our image is tarnished and our ability to function as we would like to function has been compromised. It looks like we're going to war anyway. And I say looks like we're going to war because I'm not quite sure what we're doing. I'm not quite sure what's happened yet. I'm not one of those who scoffed when the president said a couple weeks back at the press conference, I don't have a strategy yet. I thought that was really a smart thing, a brave thing to say. I remember when Hillary Clinton did those TV ads about the 3 a.m. in the morning. Who do you want answering the phone? My answer was, I want the smart guy to answer the phone, the one who's going to stop and think before he responds. I don't want the person who will respond instinctively. I want somebody who will say, I don't have a strategy yet, but I'm trying to develop one. And so I was perfectly willing and still am willing to give the president the time that he needs to assemble the pieces that he needs to assemble. I don't want him to move too quickly. If you recall, in a much easier mission, George Herbert Walker Bush and James Baker took from August until January to assemble the coalition and put in place the pieces to liberate Kuwait. And they did it rather quickly. And they did it with a huge number of troops. And they did it with fairly general support around the world. And again, it was an easier job to do. But nevertheless, it still took them 6 months or so to put all the pieces in place before they did it. So I think that those who in this country lose patience and criticize the president when he does something or criticizes him when he doesn't do something need to all take a deep breath, not hyperventilate, and give him time to think this one through. I think that if you look at the picture, it's a very complicated one. It's not like Kuwait where you had an occupying army and you had to liberate that army and then reinstall a Kuwaiti government that actually had legitimacy among its own people. What we have here is more of a calculus of multiple parts, all of them needing to be kept in balance one with another. And if you don't have them all in place, the pieces will fall apart. Even look at the bombing that took place yesterday. What was interesting was they didn't fly any sorties, but Qatar was part of the picture. Why was Qatar part of the picture? The Saudis and the Emiratis immediately said, we'll support. The Bahrainis just come along because they just come along. The Jordanians obviously have a real interest in this, even though they have a domestic problem at home in terms of becoming involved with the United States leading an effort against anybody. But Qatar was important for one reason, and that's Al Jazeera. What the Saudis and Emiratis didn't want was to become involved in a conflict that would inevitably cost civilian lives and have Al Jazeera Television, which is owned and operated out of Qatar, then broadcasting endless messages about America butchering civilians and the Saudis and Emiratis implicated in it. So they needed to keep that in. Now, that's one piece. You had to build that internal coalition just in the GCC. What about the rest? Turkey. Turkey's critical. Longest single border with Syria is Turkey. And Turkey has been an enabler of ISIS. I mean, they've actually been, I've talked to people, a TV network I'm associated with in the Middle East, says that whenever we cross over, you basically can see these guys lining up, getting their uniforms, getting their guns, and going in. And it's Turkey with has operated with impunity on the border. They've just, they've said one thing one place and another thing another place. But they've basically been turning a blind eye to this. The reality is that Turkey needs to be on board, but Turkey has a domestic problem as well. They have a government that has taken a position very similar to the position of Qatar, supporting some of these religious movements that, like the Muslim Brotherhood, but also some of the religious movements fighting the jihadist movements, they're called, in Iraq. They have a large Alawi minority population that is quite restive about picking on Syria, seeing their government in Turkey picking on Syria. They also have a Kurdish population that is quite restive and has been restive, and is therefore, if Syria breaks up, and like Iraq has pretty much broken up, and you have mobilization in the Kurdish area in Turkey to unify with the other two, you'll have movement toward an independent Kurdish state, and Turkey will have a problem. They've been fighting Kurds for years, and they don't want to reignite this battle. So Turkey's been taking it kind of easy on this. Iran is another country that actually is critical if this is to work. I mean, if this is to work, Iran is deathly afraid of the Islamic State. They see it as a threat to them as well as to their two allies, the government in Iraq and the government in Syria. But if you bring Iran in, the Saudis and the Emiratis are out, because there is, in fact, this proxy war going on between the two camps. And so the U.S. has been talking to Turkey here, and talking to Iran here, talking to the Saudis and Emiratis there. They need them all on board, but the question is, how do you do it? How do you have your wife and your mistress come to dinner with you and have everything be sweet and smooth? It's not easy. And so this complicated dance that the president is attempting to maneuver his way through is not an easy it's not an easy one at all. Our European allies, who probably have more to fear from the radicalization of these guys fighting than we do in terms of numbers alone, are more afraid of becoming involved than they are of not becoming involved. Russia, who feels that we've been pushing them around in Eastern Europe, feels that we dealt them out of the picture in Libya by overthrowing somebody that they were doing business with and then holding us responsible, as I think we partly are, for the chaos that ensued because we overthrew the dictator, walked away, and what happened in Libya is today a horrific mess. They're not willing to see it happen again. They don't want to lose another ally, and they don't want to see another failed state, but this time very close to them, with a whole lot of fighters going in to fight for the Islamic State who probably come from areas that are under Russian control. And so for them, this is a complicated picture. How do you assemble a coalition out of that? How do you create the calculus that gives people what they need to fight with you, but doesn't give them all that they want that will help, you know, have the thing blow apart? That's a tough call. And so my sense is that it appears that we're in a war. It appears that we're building a coalition, but the story's not told yet. It's just getting started. Now, I think that there are two criticisms. One is that we never should have left Iraq in the first place. That's often heard. And it's too late now. They hold Obama responsible for the whole thing. They hold the United States responsible for the whole thing. Both arguments are just bogus. Look, in 2011, we withdrew from Iraq. Now, the president claimed credit for it, but the reality was that George Bush had negotiated a status of forces agreement with Iraq in 2008 that required us to leave Iraq at the end of 2011. And if we remained, our soldiers who remained would have no legal protection for being in the country. And when the Obama administration attempted to push back on that and say, give us a little more time, keep a few more people there, Prime Minister Maliki, whether you liked him or not, was the elected government and the prime minister of the country, said no way, and he wanted us out. We left not because we wanted to leave, we left because we had an agreement that required us to leave, and we polled in Iraq in 2011. They did not want us to stay. We were not welcome. There was a percentage of people in the Sunni community who were afraid of us staying, of us leaving. They kind of an ambivalence. It was like, on the one hand, please don't go, please stay. Actually, I did a TV show, a dialogue with students in Baghdad in 2011, and it was kind of sad in a way because one of the girls, literally in one sentence, said, when we asked the question, do you want us to leave or want us to stay, she said, no, 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 you must leave, you must leave, you must leave, but not now. There was that sense of ambivalence that came through in the poll in the Sunni community. Among the Shia, it was completely the opposite. Overwhelming majorities wanted us out, and the American people wanted us out too. Do not forget that. It was not simply the president responding to his Democratic base. Overwhelmingly, the American people did not want us there. And we were losing lives. The numbers had gone down because we'd withdrawn, but frankly, we were at risk and continued to be at risk because the occupation was not popular with anyone in the country. The Syria one, we started too late. We should have done this sooner. That's nonsense. I'll tell you why. Because people look at a situation like this and they see it as a static, like we move and nobody else does. Guess what? If we had started doing more arming to the Syrian opposition, do you think that the Iranians and the Russians would not have stepped up their arms to the government? If we had taken a more aggressive posture, do you not think that Bashar al-Assad's allies would not have taken a more aggressive posture back? This was not simply a sort of everybody standing still in place waiting for us to act, and once we acted, everything would change. Once we acted, everyone else would react. I remember having a meeting at the State Department and people were talking about, you need to do a no-fly zone, you need to do a humanitarian corridor. And the people at the State Department came back and said, we've looked at the humanitarian corridor. It would take about 50,000 American troops on the ground in Syria to enforce a humanitarian corridor. People said, well, yeah, so? We were just leaving Iraq. The American people would not have tolerated 50,000 troops on the ground. Even a no-fly mission required troops on the ground in order to do the spotting of where we would target the anti-aircraft equipment. And the idea of funding the opposition, believe me, the Syrian opposition was not short of funds, ever. The problem was that the funds went everywhere. And there was no central coordination to the funds. And so what happened was we ended up funding a fragmented opposition that was facing a rather ruthless regime that in response to fighting a ruthless regime saw fragmentation actually as a benefit because there was not a central control and command. There were groups springing up everywhere able to fight on their own, and it kept the regime a little crazy. It was sort of like a whack-a-mole game where nobody quite knew where the next group was going to spring up and was going to strike. The most interesting group in the bunch was the Islamic State, because unlike everybody else, they did not pick fights. They targeted areas where the regime was weak or had left, or where opposition groups had come in and the opposition groups themselves were weak, and they took them over and they held them. They were literally building a state from the beginning. Their goal from the beginning was to hold a certain territory and control it, unlike the rest of the opposition that was fighting against the regime on a fairly regular basis and moving from this place to that place. The Islamic State was there to control territory. And they controlled territory using rather ruthless, brutal, ugly, horrific terrorism that was designed to create fear, and it succeeded. Once they created fear, they created order. It was an order based on fear. It was an order based on the fact that you knew what would happen to you if you didn't operate the way we wanted you to operate. But the notion that if we'd gotten involved sooner, there never would be an Islamic State is absolute nonsense. The only way we could have gotten involved to avoid that outcome would have been to have sent 180,000 troops into the country as we did in Iraq, and that one didn't work out too well, did it? I mean, I wonder sometimes how people have, I mean, being forgetful about, you know, you forget an anniversary, that's okay, everybody does that, you forget a birthday, that's fine too. But Jesus, when you've just finished fighting a war where you lost 4,500 people and you accomplished absolutely nothing but unleashed a sectarian war and drove Iran into becoming the regional hegemon, one would think that you would not be that quick to dive into the next one, willy-nilly. But some folks don't quite get it. And so they're kind of eager for the next one because they forgot the last one. And so the grotesqueness of ISIS is one thing. But really disliking somebody, really wanting to do something about somebody, and not knowing what you're going to do, why you're doing it, what you expect it, those are totally different things. A lot of things in the world I hate. A lot of things in the world I think are really stupid and wrong, and I would like to end and like this phone from ringing. But the issue is, You cannot strike, you cannot, I don't know if you remember the Powell Doctrine. You don't go into these things loosely. If you're going to go in, know what you're doing, understand the consequences of it, be clear about the terms of a commitment and engagement, be clear to the American people about it, let them know how long, how much you think it's going to cost, and that the consequences are X, Y, and Z. Build the support base that is sustainable throughout, and then define an exit strategy. What is winning? What does winning constitute? Those are things that are required before you commit our sons and daughters and our kids to fight a war like this. And that's why the president is taking time and moving slowly and building a coalition, because you do not want to do this just because we got the power to do it. We got the power, but the power is not sustainable if people don't support it. And so we don't have the Germans on board, don't have the British on board, we don't have the French on board, we don't have most of our big NATO allies, in other words, on board. We have Arab countries on board, which is great, but that is not sufficient to win. And at the end of the day, we still have to define the question of the who's going to fight the ground war. Now, and we have to be careful about that. There are some who are making the argument, well, in Syria, our natural partner is Bashar al-Assad. Well, actually, that's not our natural partner. Because in a serious way, what you've got ISIS playing off of is the resentment and the bitterness of a disenfranchised Sunni majority in Syria. In Iraq, it's a bitter and disenfranchised Sunni minority. I kind of understand bitter and disenfranchised minorities. I'm not always sure I understand bitter and disenfranchised majorities. I mean, it's like white people being angry in America. You know, it's like, I'm not sure what the anger is about. But you know, you have to understand it and deal with it. It's real. They have been oppressed in Syria. They've been oppressed in Iraq. And ISIS feeds off of that. Partnering with Iran, or partnering with the Maliki government, or partnering with Bashar al-Assad doesn't solve the anger and the resentment that created the problem from the bottom up that spawned ISIS in the first place. And so that's an issue that has to be dealt with. Who are our allies who will fight on the ground? For better or for worse, you have a sectarian conflict here, and it is a proxy conflict that has been, in fact, fomented and supported by external players. I mean, Iran's on one side, and the Saudis and their allies are on another side. I mean, that's a clear issue. What started as an internal Syria issue quickly became a regional proxy war, and to some extent has a U.S.-Russian overlay on it as well. It's a war within a war within a war. What you don't want to do is foment further resentment. And it's true in Syria, but it's also true in Iraq. One of the things that the president insisted upon was that Maliki had to go. Prime Minister Maliki, who had operated the most ruthless sectarian regime and had gotten away with it because we never really dealt with it at all. We criticized Bashar al-Assad. We never criticized Prime Minister Maliki. When he was devastating Fallujah, using barrel bombs, incidentally, we never even batted, and never even made the American newspapers. He was our guy. And then we realized that he wasn't our guy because it wouldn't work, because this Islamic State sprang up in Iraq first as a potent force that had to be contended with. We said, Maliki's got to go, and we put forward an agenda, not just for a new prime minister, but a new prime minister that would be inclusive and create a government that was representative, would end the disenfranchisement of the Sunni population. I'd say that the new prime minister is actually trying, but it's not succeeding. The people actually fighting on the ground against the Islamic State are, in many instances, they wear uniforms, but they are Shia militia. There's just no question. That's what we got here. Obviously, we know of the victim communities in Iraq. We know of the Yazidis. We know of the Chaldeans. We know the Assyrians. We know other groups have paid a terrible price. And Sunnis who don't adhere to the philosophy of ISIS. But here's what we don't know. We don't know that the Shia militias are themselves responsible for a lot of this. They have behaved abominably. And the Sunni militias have too. I mean, the sectarian militia war that's going on has taken toll both ways. And the issue is, though, it's not a blame game. It's a question of how do you get out of it. And you don't get out of it by pitting one of them against the other one and giving them... In other words, if the Iraqi army that is masking itself as the Shia militia, or the Shia militia masking itself as an Iraqi army, goes into Fallujah and takes it over, that doesn't solve the problem of getting ISIS out. What it does is it fuels the flames of resentment that America allied with this hostile enemy. And the only solution is to empower the Sunni population, which is what Maliki was supposed to do in 2008, when we had the election and he took over. The idea was that he would have an inclusive government. He didn't do it. And for the last 6 years, He has resisted any effort at an inclusive government, and the consequences are what are playing out on the ground. So the difficulties here are enormous, and I don't. The complexities are there. The dangers are great. I think, as I said, it's the right war. It's a group that has to be stopped. But being able to stop it and not play into their hands and fuel it is a complicated demand. And which is why the president starts with Sunni states doing the bombing as opposed to getting Iran involved in the game. And why he resists any public acceptance of the fact that Syria is notified or involved the Syrian government or that Iran is a partner, that would only make the matter worse. It would only make the matter worse. We're in it. I dare say we'll be in it for a while. I dare say that what we're doing tonight has a conversation that has to continue, because I think we're going to be facing this problem for years to come. The problem is that the time for learning was, as I said, 10 years ago. My daughter called this morning in a rage because she was listening to something on NPR, and it reminded her of a line I have in my book, how I got so frustrated at the beginning of the Iraq war, where anybody who knew five words in Arabic, the Sunni, Shia, Mujahideen, Jihad, Madrasa, whatever, if you could use two of them in a sentence, you were on television as an expert. The people who paid the price for that were us, the rest of us. I mean, there was a thing today, I got invited to hear Bob Schieffer speak at this Center for Strategic International Studies, talk about ISIS. Really? I mean, Bob, you want to talk about what it's like being a TV host on a morning talk show or a Sunday morning talk show, that's fine. But what the heck does he know about this? Other than what he read in the newspaper yesterday. I mean, I got a call one time from Fox News. They wanted, when the Afghanistan war started, and they said, we want you to come on and talk about Afghanistan. I said, I don't do Afghanistan. And she said, oh, come on. I said, actually, no, I don't know anything about that part over there. She said, well, we could give you papers to read, the morning stuff. I said, I don't know anything about it. I don't like to talk about stuff I don't know. And she laughed. She said, nobody ever says that to us. She said, we wanted you on because you're a good talker on the left, and we have somebody, a good talker on the right. And the problem is it's entertainment. But lives are at stake. And the drums were being beaten to go to war, and we did not know what we were doing. And we still don't know what we're doing. And there's a danger in that. This is not child's play. There are lives at stake, ours, and the future generations of Americans who may pay the price if we get this one wrong and we take civilian casualties and create more bitterness and resentment and pave the way for the next attack. It's a war we got to win, but you don't win it unless you know what you're doing and get it right. And I think I'll stop there and take questions. Thank you.
Okay, we have ample time for lots of questions. We will be doing, first of all, I forgot to mention earlier that we have been doing a video recording of this talk. And
oh,
so
no.
You knew that.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did. And it will be on our website. And also, if you want a DVD, it will be available if you just check with our office. We have two microphones. Yanni Carney over there, who's our membership and development person, and then Jane Myers, who is the officer for student youth exchanges. Raise your hand, and they will find you. I ask that you keep your questions to the point and as brief as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Zahn.
Oh, hi. Yeah.
So you told us a lot about the problem, but not a lot about what you think the solution is. And one of the theories I have is through the process of brutality of ISIS combined with all the refugees that have abandoned southern parts of many countries. And we reach the point where it's time to reassess boundaries and create these quote unquote ethnically pure provinces across the Middle East.
No. Because number one, that's not our call. I can't speak to Europe. I can speak to the Arab world. I mean, you have Palestinian refugees who 70 years later live in refugee camps, and the neighborhoods are the villages that they came from. I was in a debate after the signing of the Oslo Accords with the head of the guy who was the head of the Conference of Presidents of Jewish Organizations, who he and I were both supporting Oslo, but the one point he would not agree on is the right of refugees to return. And I told him stories. At one point we were speaking at Temple University, we were both graduates of Temple, and I told him the story of the first time I went to the camps and kept a diary of every day that I was there and the stories I heard and the people I met. And his response was, my parents came from Austria and I never want to go back and see the place ever. And I said, that's you, but that's not them. They write poems about the villages that they left. Now, they may go back and find the house destroyed. I mean, 483 villages leveled to the ground. They want to go back. Their attachment in their folklore, in their proverbs, in their culture is to their land. It's not, they don't want to go back to a homeland. They want to go back to their home. And they want that home. Now, I know that you have a difference here in among some of the groups. I mean, the Yazidis, their mountain is sacred to them. They cannot leave it. They lose part of their faith. The Chaldeans have been in Iraq for 6,000 years. I mean, that ethnic culture has been there 6,000 years, has been Christian for probably as long as any group, continuous, any group in the world. There are Chaldeans here in America who say, hell with it, bring them here, they're done, finished. The Chaldean patriarch does not agree. He wants a safe zone in Iraq for them to return. Now, the question though, so that's the question of the refugees and where they go and what they do. The question of the borders is of countries. Part of the problem of country borders is that once you start fiddling, everything, it's a house of cards, the whole thing falls apart. Jack Straw, who I got to know, the former foreign minister of Britain, once said, every problem that we're facing in the Middle East today, without exception, we created after World War I. He was absolutely right. From the Iraq mess, to the Syria mess, to the Lebanon sectarian governance stuff, to Israel, Palestine, I was in England on my way to Lebanon to do my dissertation research in 1971. I don't mean to insult any Brits in the audience, but I'll just, if you don't mind this detour. I was, my wife and I were there, and we were getting the British paper. We were spending a week in England before we went on to the Middle East, and I got the paper every day, and Nigeria was exploding, and South Africa was exploding, and Pakistan, Bangladesh, that was exploding over there, and Israel-Palestine was exploding, and Libya, whatever, and Sudan, and I said, whoa, wait a minute. Every one of these, the British started, and they manipulated, and then they let go, and now they're writing in the newspaper about these dirty little darkies that can't get along with each other. A little ownership might be due. Now, what? I mean, look, I did my dissertation on this whole thing, and I'm a pollster. I do the polling in the Middle East. My brother does the domestic polling. The very first poll ever commissioned of the Arab world was Woodrow Wilson after World War I. The British and French wanted to carve the region up into little pieces, and Woodrow Wilson articulated his principle of self-determination and said, we give people what they want. Let's see what they want. And so he sent King Crane two guys, a president and a businessman, president of a university and a businessman, to the Middle East, and they surveyed a couple thousand people throughout the what was called Greater Syria at the time. And guess what? They came back with almost unanimous support for Greater Syria, for the region to be one whole country. The British foreign minister at the time said, I don't care what the natives want. That's what he said. I don't give a hoot what the natives want. Our ambitions are far more important than their aspirations. And the rest played out from there. So I believe that the borders are not sustainable, but I believe that the only way that they'll change is when the people in the region themselves make the determination how to change them. This has to come about. We tried it after World War I, and guess what? We don't do it again. It's up to them. The point is that we've got to get over these humps right now to get to a point where they can do that. So, yeah.
Hi. You mentioned the word legitimacy, I think, just once when you were talking about Iraq.
I was actually talking about the Kuwaiti government going back with legitimacy.
Yes. In that part of the world, legitimacy is really a strange question because you have Jordan, which is probably 80% Palestinian, run by a king. You have all those Gulf countries where 70-80% of the population are not citizens. Bahrain is run by a Shia, by a Sunni, even though it's a Shia majority and so on. Legitimacy seems like a rather strange concept. And I just wonder if you can comment on that. And the second thing is, I'm now convinced of all the things we shouldn't do and we shouldn't have done. Do you have any suggestions about things we maybe should do?
Mm-hmm. First on the legitimacy question, there are different degrees of legitimacy and different forms of legitimacy. It is possible in a tribal society for a ruler to have legitimacy and be seen as the, to use the word again, the legitimate ruler. Now, there are a lot of groups in Kuwait who don't feel that way. Palestinians did not. Many of them didn't. Many of the other people who worked in the country didn't. But among Kuwaitis, among the main families in Kuwait,